The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Science Weekly with me, Ian Samble. Welcome to the Anthropocene.
We're changing landscapes, climate, chemistry, biodiversity. Every part of our planet is now influenced in some way by humanity.
The aptly named Gaia Vince discusses her book Adventures in the Anthropocene, an epic survey of how humankind has remade Earth and the battle against ourselves for survival. Also, we discuss research into the anti-cancer effects of aspirin and science prizes galore. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week to lend her wit and wisdom is Nicola Davis, science writer and commissioning editor on Observer Tech Monthly. Nicola, welcome back to the pod.
Hello.
Let's kick off with this gaggle of science prizes, not least an update on our last edition of the podcast dedicated to the Longitude Prize 2014. What's been going on in prize world?
Well, so it's quite a hot topic at the moment. So the Longitude Prize, if you recall, last week we looked at the six potential challenges which could have one out as being the challenge which is going to be put forward for the Longitude Prize. And the one which the public have voted for is the fight against antibiotic resistance. So that hit the headlines this week. So the £10 million fund is now going to be directed towards coming up with some sort of device that will help to ensure that when doctors are prescribing antibiotics, they're prescribing it at the right times and make sure that they're prescribing it for bacterial infections and not viral infections, which is one big problem that they're tackling with at the moment, that often there is confusion and about whether an illness is in fact caused by a virus or a bacteria. And so they need some way of being able to tell the two apart. So that's going to be one of the main focuses for this prize. So that £10 million fund is going in that direction. And then another headline story was that the first breakthrough prizes have been awarded as well. And this is in the field of mathematics. This is $5.3 million prizes which have been given to mathematicians. And it's a huge amount of money to be given to be shared among five people, let alone to go to each to five people. So prizes all over the place.
What do you make of the breakthrough prize in mathematics? We've had these previous breakthrough prizes in the life sciences and in physics. And the idea is that they're kind of supposed to turn scientists or help elevate scientists in the sort of public mind to this kind of rock star status. And Yuri Milner, one of the guys behind it, and on the Mass Prize, it's sponsored with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. They want this prize to, say, make sort of these scientists into rock stars, but also to kind of free them up, to give them enough money to free them up so they can do maybe the maths that they couldn't do beforehand and all this sort of thing. But what do you make of that? Do you think these prizes are going to achieve that kind of aim?
Well, I do think that there is, you know, some merit in the idea that it maybe makes the whole idea of maths and sciences in general more sexy. You know, you have these big celebrities. You know, we all know, for example, who Peter Higgs is now. That's no bad thing. So in that sense, yes, perhaps there is a role for it. I think, you know, the idea that you wouldn't be able to do the maths without this money is possibly a little less worthy a notion, in the sense that, you know, there are grants, there are research grants, there's the usual way of funding for research to happen. That's all still there. So it's not as though this is the only way to be able to fund your research. And in fact, these prizes are given to people for doing fantastic research, which they've done without any of this prize money. So I don't think that's really a particularly valid point. Also, you know, this isn't the only prize in mathematics. There's the Fields Medal, which is knocking on for $14,000, and the Abel Prize, which is $1 million. Okay, there's no Nobel Prize in mathematics, but these are still huge sums of money. I think possibly the idea that it's given to somebody after they've already made a great breakthrough also is, you know, it's great to reward somebody, but that money's not necessarily going to go back into the mathematics anyway. I mean, one of the winners said he's going to pay off his mortgage, which, you know, is great, wonderful, but, you know, it's not like it's actually necessarily funding further research.
Mm. I think it's interesting to look across those maths prizes in particular, because the Fields Medal is given to a mathematician under 40 and is a real career boost. If you land the Fields Medal, you can start to call a lot of shots in your department. You can you know, become very, very employable. It's very good for your career. The Abel Prize is far more. The money with the Fields Medal is pretty negligible. As you said, it's less than £10,000, I think, or around that kind of mark. The Abel Prize is a lot more, but again, it's given at the sort of at the end of someone's career. I mean, that prize goes out to people in their sort of 60s, 70s and whatnot. And the Breakthrough Prizes are trying to aim for somewhere in between and in making sure that those prizes all go to active mathematicians or active scientists. And this year, the oldest was 56. The youngest was, I think, 36. And so they're rewarding people who are just very, very smart at doing what they do. Although it's interesting to know really what will those prizes achieve. I think they do actually give some prominence, and it's hard to think really what becomes a role model for a kid going into school in mathematics. I mean, clearly they need to have some kind of aptitude and all the rest of it, and maybe seeing these kinds of stories and these guys being bandied around in the press may catch their eye. Obviously they don't read newspapers, they may see the news online. But I had some criticisms from other scientists, other mathematicians I spoke to about this, and one of them was saying, look, I don't understand. This was a guy who's very prominent mathematician in the UK saying, I don't understand half of the mathematics my peers are doing. The idea that you're going to make rock stars out of people who do something that 99% of the population don't understand is quite a tall order. But I think there is this issue that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Yuri Milner are both coming from very numerate backgrounds. I mean, Yuri Milner was training as a physicist until he ditched that to do business. Zuckerberg, of course, you know, coding, computer programming at Harvard. They do, I think, want to give something back, but they want to give something back in a very high-profile way, and I don't begrudge them that.
I think there is something to be said for saying, you know, you don't just have to be doing sexy science to win a prize. You know, it shouldn't always be science that can easily be distilled into 140 characters that should be winning prizes, and that I think that's really valid. And one of the things you were saying about the Fields Medal being given to, you know, young researchers under 40, well, that's all very well and good, but look at Andrew Wiles, who proved Fermat's Last Theorem and was, what, a year over 40? You know, and he lost out on the Fields Medal. I mean, okay, he's had, you know, huge accolades and rightly so, but, you know, in a way, that's sort of a rather arbitrary line to draw in the sand.
Well, it's quite strange that his student, Richard Taylor, who is now at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton, won the Breakthrough Prize for Mathematics this year. And Taylor helped Andrew Wiles with a gap in the mathematics to help solve Fermat's Last Theorem. Andrew Wiles didn't get the prize. And it's because maybe he's a little bit older and so on like that. So, yeah, there's some quirks in this.
The other thing is with this £10 million fund for the Longitude Prize, now, obviously, as we said, focused on antibiotic resistance, is exactly how and when that money is going to be given to people. Because, you know, one of the big things about this prize was, you know, it could be anybody can enter, anyone can put forward their idea. So it could be a university research group, it could be a DPhil student, it could be a, you know, lady in her garden shed comes up with a great plan, let's do that. The question here is, of course, that if you're going to pursue, you know, inventing some kind of device, that takes time and it takes money. And that money's got to come from somewhere. Now, if you're only going to be funded perhaps at the end, if you win this competition, you could be sinking a lot of time and energy and money into this. And that's, you know, that's not how university research happens. You get given a grant for a good proposal, and then you get the money to go away and actually do the research. So in a way, it does feel a bit like, you know, hedging your bets and saying, well, we're not going to give you the money till we see the answer. And then does that mean perhaps that, you know, it's going to be some university research group who have the financial backing to do the initial research necessary? I mean, how likely is it that some, you know, inventive genius who is not at such an institution is going to actually have the capacity, the financial backing to be able to take up this sort of challenge?
We know that the Longitude Prize Committee is going to be bashing out some of these details over the summer, and one of the things they need to do is really nail down the criteria of what they really want and what the milestones are along the way. And they've got, you know, the people going in for this prize have got 5 years, a maximum of 5 years, to do that kind of development. They said to me that they were willing and maybe giving out some of the £10 million to help people develop particular ideas, but that there a lump sum will still be awarded to the person or team deemed the winner at the end of the process. So there will be some money coming out of that, but I think that's a little bit sort of undecided at the moment quite how that will work. And I guess it's undecided because they don't know who's going to come in with what ideas. So prizes, good or bad?
Well, I think that they certainly do have a role, and they obviously have a good motivational role. And as we've seen with the X prizes, it is a way to solve some problems or to get some research moving. But I don't think we should negate the importance of research grants and good long-term funding for prospective projects.
One of the stories I wrote about last week was on the back of a paper about looking at the effects of low-dose aspirin for people going on to develop pancreatic cancer. And this was quite an interesting one because there's been a sort of smattering of studies coming out over the past 5 or 10 years suggesting that this really common and widespread and cheap pill might have some kind of benefit in protecting against cancer. And the mechanisms of how that may be happen, how that may work, are still being kicked around. But the reason these researchers at Yale were looking at pancreatic cancer was that it's really one of those tough cancers to beat. And really, if you can find anything that can help prolong the lives or prevent people getting it, then it's worth knowing about that. And what they did, they were based at Yale, so in Connecticut, they looked at, they got a bunch of healthy controls and then a bunch of people who had been freshly diagnosed with pancreatic cancer from the hospitals all over that state. So it's pretty representative of that area of the US. And then they looked at, I mean, this is a tricky part of the study that they use. They basically interview them and they ask about aspirin usage. Some of them were on low-dose aspirin for cardiovascular risk. And so those people tend to be taking one pill, say 75 milligrams up to about 300 milligrams a day for quite a long time. So and it's something that's come in the last 10, 15, 20 years that you will start, doctors would start putting people at risk of cardiovascular disease onto low-dose aspirin just because it helps, it stops blood platelets clotting together, sticking together, and so it stops blood clots in your system. So the results from the study were showing that those people who've been taking aspirin for 3 years before the study began had about a 48% reduced risk of developing pancreatic cancer. And then if they've been taking it for, say, 20 years before the study, the reduction went up to about 60%. But what it doesn't tell you is whether it's actually aspirin doing that job. And you have the always tricky problem in that asking people what they've done over the past 5, 10 years, 20 years is notoriously flaky. But what the researcher said to me is, well, if you have someone say, yeah, I was taking aspirin daily for 5 years, you could be pretty sure they were taking it for some period of time between say 6 months and 20 years rather than not taking it at all. And, you know, this is the size of the error margins you're talking about. But they still, and other scientists I spoke to about the study, still think that there is probably something going on here, that it is having some effect, but it still needs more work on it.
You said there about the problem of knowing whether someone who says they've been taking it every day really has been taking it every day. Is there a problem that their normal healthy controls who allegedly haven't been taking it, that they could have been taking it, you know, they come home after a late night, have a couple of aspirin before they go to bed, but it doesn't clock as being one of their daily tablets? You know, is there also possibility that their control group might have been taking aspirin and not necessarily been?
I'm sure there's going to be some of that, but imagine how, I think it's unlikely that someone would falsely imagine that they had been taking aspirin when they hadn't, or also, you know, full stop, or think that they hadn't been taking it when they had. I mean, I think if you'd been taking aspirin for, say, a year or 3 years or 5 years pretty religiously.
But I mean, that was daily, but if you'd, say, take aspirin a couple of times a week, as people might well do without necessarily considering it part of their medication.
Yeah, that all of that's going to be in there, yeah. I think. And it's one of the tricky things. Because it becomes one of those studies that, at best, it means you go and look harder. And people are doing intervention studies now, so they're taking just a bunch of people, putting some on aspirin, others not on it, and seeing what happens. And that's obviously going to take a long while before you see what shakes out from those kinds of studies.
So would we say that essentially the study is in and of itself showing potentially an interesting effect, but it's you know, as you say, it flags up that this could be something worth investigating further, but there are clearly flaws in the procedure?
Yeah, I think it's suggestive. of some kind of benefit, but it's too early to go and do anything about it. I mean, the scientists I spoke to was saying, the scientists who led the study was saying, it's you don't want to just go out as a healthy person and start taking low-dose aspirin to because in the belief that it's going to protect you against pancreatic cancer, because there are side effects of taking aspirin, even low-dose aspirin, and the biggest side effect is gastrointestinal bleeds, getting bleeds in your stomach lining. And those are rarely fatal, but they can be fatal, and they get more problematic the older you are. So if you're taking aspirin from your, say, 40s or something, could that lead you into other issues? And there have been some hints of other problems that could be coming along mm-hmm. with taking so much aspirin over, you know, sort of over such long periods. But it's all very, you know, that's still quite sort of contentious. I think what the scientists were saying to me was that if you have come from a family where there is a real history of pancreatic cancer and your doctor says, look, you're really high at risk, you might want to look at low dose aspirin, which is, you know, under sort of the 400 milligrams, under 325 milligrams in this study a day. Look at that and talk to your GP about whether that can help in your sort of on a kind of risk benefit type analysis, you know, whether it might be worth taking the risk. But it's still really early days on that.
Aspirin obviously is something that you can just pop down to the shop and buy. I mean, studies like this, which come out with these big headlines that, you know, could help reduce your risk of cancer, etc. Do you feel that there's at all a danger that people are just going to maybe not talk to their GP and just sort of start self-medicating? I mean, you know, it's not an over-the-counter drug.
No, I think that's happening. And is it a danger? In some cases, it will be, yeah. I think that's the facts, yeah.
One of the other things I think is sort of interesting about this study, and perhaps it's sort of so obvious, maybe it isn't interesting, but this is aspirin we're talking about. This is a drug that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. Is it not wonderfully surprising that such a drug that's been around for so long still has the ability to make us sit up and think?
It is a really nice thing. And you know, it's frustrating that they don't have a really good idea of what the mechanism of might be of aspirin causing, having this kind of protective effect. And bear in mind, if you look at studies on bowel cancer, aspirin, the evidence for aspirin protecting against bowel cancer is much better than it mm-hmm. is for pancreatic cancer. It seems as if cancers of the digestive tract actually are kind of responsive in some way to aspirin. And they don't know where in the course of that disease it's having its effect. Because bear in mind, you know, pancreatic cancer will be starting in you and then developing 10, 15 years before you get a diagnosis. And then you may live a couple of years, or you may live 6 months or what have you. But it is under the radar for a long time. And so you don't know quite when aspirin is having its effect, at what stage in the disease. So how is it working? And one of the ideas out there is that because aspirin is understood to make blood platelets less sticky, and that's how it works, because you don't want to have these clots going around in your blood, so people at risk of heart disease, you know, will take low-dose aspirin for that reason. Obviously gives them a higher risk if they have a hemorrhagic stroke, because a hemorrhagic stroke means a burst blood vessel in the brain, and so the bleeding will continue longer because their blood clots less quickly. But one of the ideas on the anti-cancer mechanism may be that when cancer cells are forming in their real infancy in your body, they can be carried around the body on platelets. And so if the platelets aren't as sticky, that maybe these cancer cells don't stick to them and you reduce that. But it's all very much sort of speculative at the moment. Thanks, Nicola.
No problem.
Well, for all those stories and the best science news on the web, just go to theguardian.com/science. The battle between exploitation and protection of the world's natural resources and our ability to do this at a global scale has marked this epoch on the planet in a very particular and dramatic way. The term Anthropocene was coined by ecologist Eugene F. Turmer in the 1980s, but for science writer Gaia Vince, the term began to become a dominant theme in her work as an editor at Nature magazine, so much so that she packed her job in and set out on a global journey to understand what the Anthropocene really means. The result of which is her new book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. When Gaia came into the Science Weekly studios, I asked her first to outline what the term Anthropocene means.
Over the past 50 years, the human impact on our planet has grown, it's accelerated and become truly global. our influence is now so profound that geologists are saying that we are having such a planetary effect that we're changing the actual geology, we're changing landscapes, climate, chemistry, biodiversity. Every part of our planet is now influenced in some way by humanity. And we're not in the Holocene epoch anymore, which is the age that we are supposed to be living in, according to geologists. We're now in an entirely different geological age, the Anthropocene, the age of humans.
So it's much more than climate change. It's much more than that big issue. It's about using up resources. It's about all these other things that are going on with human activity, not just about emissions.
Look, when geologists say the Anthropocene, and it is a geological term, I mean, in this book, I've actually taken it on a broader, more social view. But for the geologists, when they look at changes to the planet, what they've historically looked at is stripes in the rock. So from that, we can tell, for example, when a great extinction occurred or when there was a massive climate change or a new chemical put into the atmosphere. And these things historically have occurred because of a great asteroid impact or a super volcanic eruption. And this is really extraordinary. It's the first time a species has knowingly changed the planet in such a way, and it is a first. We are at the beginning of this geological age, and it is unique because we're leaving this stripe in the rock, but the geologists are having to decide whether we're in a new age before the stripe has been left.
So you left your job at Nature down the road to do all the research for this book, and it was pretty extensive, the research that you've done, a lot of traveling, a lot of interviewing with people. But what was it about the Anthropocene, of all the issues that a science journalist can pick on to write a book about, what was it about the Anthropocene that grabbed you so much to make you do that?
Well, I was sitting at my desk and I was aware, of course, of all these new stories coming in, these new papers. And I was the editor. I'd send journalists off to report on all these different things. So someone saying a new type of frog is going extinct. Someone else saying that oceans are becoming more acid. Someone else saying global warming is the greatest it's been in hundreds of thousands of years. All these very different things happening. And then scientists would extrapolate and say, this is what is going, how it's going to affect humans. This is how it's going to affect these people or this city. But actually, I was aware that it's already affecting people. And it's affecting people largely in the tropics and largely in the poor world. And these people were the ones that I really wanted to talk to. And the only way that I was going to hear from these people, hear from these stories as they're actually happening in this extraordinary time, was if I went out there, found them, and discovered what they had to say. And they had a lot to say. It was they were really remarkable people, actually.
So you quit your job, you get on a plane. I mean, what are you looking for? What do you set out to look for?
What I want to see is some aspect of our extreme time, whether it's the disappearance suddenly of glaciers that have been there for thousands of years, or complete change in landscape. So where a forest has been standing again for thousands of years, and now suddenly we're creating our own cropland, or we've turned it into a desert. I wanted to meet people who are actually living in those places. And I wanted to go further. I didn't just want to hear sort of sob stories, and there are plenty of those, of people who are really struggling, but I wanted to find those inspirational stories and things that we could learn from. You know, I can learn from in my city home of how people are effectively geoengineering their environment to make it better, either for their community or to somehow artificially create the natural landscape that was there before the Anthropocene, the Holocene landscape.
That's what one of the things I liked about the book is you're not going around just documenting the scars, if you like, that humanity's leaving on the planet. And I hesitate to use scars because a lot of these things are people doing what they need to do to get by. And it's a lot of that damage is caused by them being just having to survive and be creative and inventive and all the rest of it. But you also obviously do talk to an awful lot of people who, as you say, are coping with the issues of all of this, the fallout of all of this intensive effort and so on. I mean, I was keen to hear sort of what sort of things did you see that were the most striking ways that we are changing the planet?
Well, there's everything from mountaintop removal, from glacial disappearance, from artificial islands. You know, Dubai is effectively an artificial place. And there's plenty of examples of cities in the desert. There's also examples of people growing vegetables in the desert. You know, I mean, we are the engineers of this massive change that's occurring to the planet, and there are plenty of human victims, there are plenty of animal and plant victims, but we're also the only species capable of rectifying the situation for our own survival, let alone for other animals and plants. And we're already doing that. I mean, a lot of the changes we've made to the planet have been to our benefit. You know, we live now in places that would have been impossible for our hunter-gatherer predecessors. But we're also pushing the planet and its ecosystems to situations where we're at the edge. We're in crises to do with food, water, energy, ecosystem services, the services that the biosphere provides for us, like cleaning our air and our water. But people are genuinely trying to turn that around. They're trying to. So I met a person, for example, living. He's a retired railway engineer in the very remote part of Indian Ladakh, in the Tibetan part, and he is recreating glaciers. So the glaciers have gone because of global warming, because of what we're all doing to the planet. But he is recreating them. And because of that, he's now getting the irrigation juice for his crops so that people can carry on living there.
So how does he do that? How is this guy recreating glaciers?
Well, glaciers are themselves movable entities. They're these huge natural water stores. And in terms of the water cycle, they're absolutely vital because, for example, Ladakh is a high altitude desert. It doesn't rain there. Very, very rarely. And so these glaciers hold vital water. And when the sun hits them at a certain time of the year, so sort of late spring, summer, they start to melt a little. And that's where the irrigation for crops come from. So if these have disappeared, which they are already disappearing over large portions of the Himalayas, then they're really stuck. And what's happening is a lot of people are now migrating away from the area. And that's the end of that cultural legacy, if you like, of a huge and important tradition for humanity. So this guy is actually creating artificial glaciers. And he does that by finding a portion of the mountains that's in shadow for a greater amount of the year. And then he very cleverly sculpts the rocks around there. So he creates a kind of basin that slows down what precipitation there is and allows it to settle in certain places. And he, with channels and culverts and so on, he slows it down enough that it freezes in that place. And it's not a true glacier. I mean, true glaciers are meters thick and they're not at risk of melting, but it's enough. It's enough for the irrigation water for the villages there.
You have this other story in your book where there are Peruvians painting their mountains white.
Yes, that's actually an extraordinary story. It's something that you wouldn't believe people would even contemplate. And I guess that shows how desperate people really are. The Andes is another mountain chain where it's completely desert, and it's actually the water source. The glaciers there are actually the water source for everything from the city, the coastal cities, to parts of the Amazon. So they're really, really important. And the glaciers there have been disappearing at some of the fastest rates on the planet. So the idea was to recreate what glaciers actually do. And the reason that glaciers manage generally to withstand the summer heat is because they're white. They're very, very reflective. So the heat doesn't get absorbed like it does with a black stone. It's reflected back. And so the ice stays there. So this guy in Peru had this idea that what he would do was paint the mountain white, and that would increase its albedo, increase its reflectivity. So it would be cool enough that any water that did, or any snow that did land there, would freeze and would stay there. And then as that built up, you would get this gradual whitening effect, and the glacier would be like a natural glacier eventually. So he's effectively seeding a glacier with paint rather than with actual frozen water. It's a huge task. I mean, he's actually started. He's got a couple of helpers, villagers who don't want to leave their village. They're going up there every day with white paint, literally painting the mountain. I mean, it's something that I wouldn't have believed unless I'd been up there. I mean, it's just...
Is it just an
absolutely Herculean task.
Is it working?
Apparently it is working. Apparently it started to work. So what the plan with this is that he's going to freeze a small area, and then with a wind turbine, he's going to pump water up a little bit more and allow it to trickle down over his whitened area and get more and more precipitation that way to settle. And yeah, I mean, it might work, you know, it might work for that mountain. It might work for that mountain's villages that are below, that rely on the runoff from that glacier. But is it a solution for all the villages in the area? At the moment, I would say it's very unlikely. Oh, what are we going to do? Spray paint the mountains? I mean, it's just extraordinary. The lengths we can go to, you know, rather than just combating global warming. But you know, we're already committed to so much warming that really we do need to look at these things. I mean, what are we going to do?
Won't the paint get into the water?
Well, it's some sort of, what's he using? Some sort of egg white and flour mixture. I don't know.
So it's something non-toxic. It wouldn't matter if it did get in. I'm sure they've thought of this.
It goes on the rock and it doesn't, I mean, it stays there. It doesn't enter the water, the water supply.
There was another story that I wanted you to tell people about, which I thought was really fascinating, which is this guy making an artificial island of sort of rubbish out in the Caribbean, I think it was. And tell us what that was all about.
Well, I mean, rubbish is actually one of our greatest problems. We are trashing, literally trashing the planet, and the oceans they've basically been our toilet, our sewer, because until recently we did have a small population. We could throw stuff in the ocean. First of all, it would biodegrade. And secondly, the ocean's so big, we could take it. It could take it. But now we're in this situation where there's so many of us and we're producing non-degradable things, you know, plastics that stay around forever. So our oceans are actually becoming really quite artificial. What he's doing is he's in an area of the Caribbean where they're suffering from another human effect, which is that we're acidifying the ocean, which means that coral struggles to grow because coral is dissolved in acid. I mean, it's very, very energy intensive for coral to carry on building. So the reefs, which usually make up the islands in this part of the Caribbean, are disintegrating. They're becoming weaker, and then with these storm surges caused by rising sea levels, they're washing away, and it's a big problem. So in terms of creating land there, the land is disappearing. It's literally disappearing into the ocean. So are the beaches. So what he's doing is collecting rubbish, and he's using it, he's tying it up. Something he actually noticed was happening originally. He noticed that the rubbish that coalesced in the ocean was becoming colonized. So these are Anthropocene islands, I guess. They're naturally occurring. So the rubbish coalesces, and then plants take seed, and the roots bind these things together, and then birds poo on the seeds, and that fertilizes it. And you get these islands that, at the root, it's not coral anymore, it's garbage. And he noticed that happening and thought, wow, I can make my own island. So it was amazing. You know, there were seaweeds and all sorts growing around his garbage island. He built up layer by layer. Off his island, we could see manatees swimming around. I mean, it was like a completely artificial ecosystem, but fantastic. You know, he's built houses on it. It's got two houses on it, you know, right, and a pig farm. So... Well, pig farm. He's got pigs. I mean,
but you can sort of go out to it on a boat.
On a little boat, yeah. You can swim off it, do your fishing.
And if sea level rises, it'll rise with the sea level.
It'll rise with it, and he can just build up with more garbage. That's something that is not... That's one of the resources that's not in short supply.
It feels a little bit sort of Mad Max. It's kind of sort of just ridiculous dystopian view of people living on mountains of rubbish, but it's real. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't that? Is it an uplifting story or a depressing one? I don't know.
We've always done that. I mean, if the geologists of the far future were to come back and say, what was the Anthropocene? You know, if they were to come to London right now, they could dig through layer by layer. You know, we've built on Roman garbage. you know, and then after that there's like medieval crap, and then we just build up layer by layer, you know, the rubble of Victoria. I read the other day that people in Fulham and Chelsea who are having basement excavations are actually embedding their diggers in the basement underneath their buildings because it's cheaper than excavating the digger. So I mean, we are living on garbage already. You know, how much of the subsoil is actually natural? It's just the next stage.
Tell us about your time in Lake Turkana in the Rift Valley. You had an interesting time there, I think.
That is an extraordinary part of the world. I mean, so this is a beautiful part of East Africa. Lake Turkana is on the border of northern Kenya and southern Ethiopia. It's a war-torn area of tribal groups, and it was quite hazardous getting there, actually. I mean, there's no buses, there's no transport to get there. We got a lift from a Catholic missionary who was going up there to the mission there. But at the time that I visited, it was during a really horrific drought. Animals, even people, were dying. So people there were really pushed to the edge of what it means to coexist on a really harsh landscape. You know, what water sources there were being fought over. People were being, the animals were being fought over. Wild animals were dying. There were carcasses of everything from camel to cow. And yeah, it was a really eye-opening, horrible journey. But at the same time, this is how people live, and this is how people are living now on the cusp of the Anthropocene. So as we go on, one thing I wonder is, will these nomadic tribes actually still exist? I mean, they're really beautiful people. You know, they have extraordinary intricate beads, dresses, their language is beautiful, they sing constantly, and it's really beautiful songs. In the great homogenization that we're creating here, will there be a space for nomadic tribes people? Will there be a place for that way of life? You know, will we all have to be intensive farmers? I mean, that's actually, nomadic pastoralism is actually one of the most sustainable ways of farming.
Getting back to the stories, though, you talk about, you know, the people doing all of these things. I mean, they speak of the will of individuals to sort of persevere and invent around these problems that they're facing in their local areas. But isn't all of this kind of futile against the forces that they face?
There's always this problem. We're undergoing a planetary event. This is something which is, I mean, it is global, and we're individuals, but we're also part of this superorganism, if you like, humanity. It's like a big beast. It's like Frankenstein's big monster. It's bumbling around, bashing its way, blindly knocking the climate out, blindly wiping out half the frog species, you know. And individuals have perhaps as little sway as an ant in an ant hive, you know. They can do very little. But on the other hand, they can certainly do something for their own life and perhaps for their own family, their greater family, their tribe or their community. Ultimately, this monster, this Frankenstein's monster, is not this creation that just appeared. You know, it's a manifestation of individuals, and certain people have a lot more sway than others. You know, we've already, for example, improved the situation with the ozone layer. We've stopped that big expanse, and that was due to a few individuals standing up and saying, this is something that we really need to sort. And it was sorted out on a global scale. A lot of the examples in the book are actually individuals sorting out local problems, but they're ideas that can be taken up by different communities in different places. And these might only be suitable for one village. They might do nothing, or they might be the new way that we all live. We might all start farming in this new way. We might all start treating global warming as something that can be dealt with by improving the reflectivity of the earth in some way. I mean, these are global problems, but it's down to individuals to come up with the solutions. A lot of the solutions are there. We know what they are. We know what we're doing for climate, for example. We know what we're doing when it comes to deforestation. We're chopping down too many trees. We're emitting too much CO2. It's not a big mystery. But in order to solve those problems, it's down to individuals and then others to follow them. We're sentient beings. We're not ants.
Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made, is published in hardback by Chatto & Windus and available on and offline now. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for the best science and environment news, day or night, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio, or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.